This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. This is The Morning Run with Xiaoning and Chuang. In about half an hour, we'll be speaking to Wong Chen, MP for Subang, on the COVID-19 bill. But in the meantime, we have a poll running on Twitter asking you, is the country spending too much money in the wake of the COVID-19 since our debt levels are approaching the ceiling? And you have three options. Yes, too much money. More austerity is needed. No, it's necessary, or not sure. So please weigh in with your thoughts and your votes. But in the meantime, let's talk about refugees. Because the Home Minister, Dato' Hamzah Zainuddin, said that Putrajaya will review the status of refugees who have been issued with cards by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, the Home Minister actually disagreed with the idea that UNHCR is a legitimate document identifying refugees.
And said the government does not have any idea how this card works. So this discussion actually came about in response in Parliament to a question by RLMP, Dato' Sri Shahidan Kasim, who claimed that the UNHCR cards are freely issued to anyone who applies for them at the agency headquarters, and she called for the Immigration Department to be the one to decide who becomes a cardholder. But however, Shahidan did not provide any evidence to support his claims. And we know that as at the end of June, there's reportedly close to 180,000 refugees and asylum seekers registered with the UNHCR in Malaysia.
So to give us some insight into the situation, we speak to Elise Aryan Chen, who is the Refugee Action Programme Officer at Naganita. Elise, welcome to the show. Now, the Home Ministry says that the number of refugees in the country is increasing despite efforts to keep it static. Does this mirror what you're actually seeing on the ground?
So I think I've been monitoring the numbers based on UNHCR statistics over the last few years. I think currently the number is about 177,000, showing that it kind of fluctuates very mildly. So I've seen it go up and down by just a few thousand. So I remember about 2 years where it was about 180,000. So we do see that it does change, you know, because refugees get resettled, they get repatriated back home. You do have deaths, you do have some that are born here. But we also do hear of refugees who then get their refugee status taken away and then new refugees getting their status. So it's not always the same population, but the number never really increases so drastically, actually.
Yeah, Elise, talk to us about the UNHCR cards issued to refugees. How stringent would you say the application process is?
I think to say that the card is given to anyone who applies for it is quite inaccurate based on the conversations that I have with the refugees regularly about the RSD process. That's the refugee status determination process that they go through. When you apply for an appointment, it's such a long wait to get your interview in the first place. But that interview basically tries to pick out really what was your experience in your country of origin that leads you to have a well-founded fear of persecution, of discrimination, of violence. Because UNHCR recognizes that there are people who take advantage of the system to get refugee protection. And this isn't unique to Malaysia, right? This has happened in places like Australia, where we hear reports of Malaysians themselves who are applying for refugee status for that protection, for that form of documentation. But so recognizing that there are people who take advantage of this, we do see that there are very strict interview processes that any discrepancy, any inconsistency in your story actually breaks apart the whole application and you could actually lose the chance of that refugee status.
But at least I just want to check, it is the government's prerogative not to recognize the UNHCR cards, right?
So it technically, yes, because it's technically they don't recognize that it's a legal document because they haven't signed on to that 1951 convention that really recognizes the status of refugees, because UNHCR as a UN body operates under that. And without signing on to the convention, the government is basically saying that we don't really understand your process. We don't agree with your process and by your definition of what refugees stand for. So because of that itself, they say that it's not legal.
So refugees in Malaysia are not given the right to work because Malaysia has not ratified the 1951 Refugee Convention. So, but are they given any other kind of assistance?
I don't think that we always just have to sign the convention, though, to give them, not to give them, they already have rights, but to recognize these rights. The reason why they can't work is because they don't have that documentation, the visa that allows a foreigner to hold employment here, right? And because of that, That stops them from accessing so many other facilities to survive here in the country. If you're talking about support that comes from the government beyond what's given by UNHCR and NGOs, so we do see that there is a 50% discount in public hospitals that's been an agreement between UNHCR and the government, and these are for asylum seekers and refugees who are registered with UNHCR. But beyond that, we don't see any other substantial forms of support on a wide range. When it comes to work, we see work pilot programs that have come up here now and again, but they're usually only for a specific small group of refugees from a particular ethnicity and nationality. And it's usually very small scale, and it's always just a pilot program. We've seen, say, for the Syrian refugees, quite a number of them are given the opportunity to apply for the IMM-13 documentation, which acts as that documentation which should help with their security. But then we do hear stories on the ground where there are authorities who don't recognize that form of documentation, and they get arrested anyway. So then the question is really, how useful is this piece of paper? And then we do hear of Yemeni refugees based on discussions that took place between the two governments, allows Yemeni refugees to hold the social visa visit pass. So then that also acts as a proper formal visa. They are here still as refugees, but then they are documented different from other refugees. But so we see any of these kind of support, if you could say, be more focused on particular groups instead of wide across. And it's not really significant enough that can create something sustainable within the entire population.
And Elise, in this post-COVID-19 era, what are some of the issues refugees face now particularly?
So I think like all communities here in Malaysia, refugees also suffered from the loss of livelihood, with a lot of them being daily wage earners and such. But I don't want to go too much into it because these are issues that even Malaysians ourselves are going through. But with that, we've seen that it's lasted way past. And now that we've been in the RMCO, we see that refugees find it even more difficult to actually find any form of income. The schools are all shutting down because they don't have funding anymore. They can't sustain their operations. But I think during this MCO period, trying to curb COVID-19, what we saw that is most significant was the xenophobia that came out, because the Rohingya boats tried to come in and we saw a huge backlash, and understandably so, because we're trying to fight the virus at this moment, and that kind of fueled even more fear and hate among people. And I think people needed a scapegoat. And so the refugee community has been facing the brunt of that. And as an impact, based on what we see on the ground and what we hear from the refugee community themselves, apart from the loss of their income, they're also facing eviction. People are much more careful about renting out spaces to them. And so then we hear in certain areas, huge amounts of them just being out of a home.
Yeah, so at least this double jeopardy of not having work and the xenophobia as well, what is the situation report where Tenaga Nita is concerned in your terms of your engagement with the government on these things?
Now, it's been quite hard when it comes to government advocacy, because we've seen the change of government so frequently, right? And every minister is a bit different. Quite previously, when we would go into different ministries to say right to work, right to healthcare, they would point us back to Security Council and to the whole ministry to say this is a documentation issue. Now, that was a few governments back. Now, with this new government, we're hoping to have some engagement. There are talks of speaking to the labor resources minister, as he's been tasked to look into all the issues surrounding the right to work. So we are hoping to embark on that. We're also working on policy papers, trying to push in for the right to work, right to healthcare and education. And we're also doing that in a group together with other organizations, but with refugee community leaders themselves, more importantly, in a group called React Refugee Action for Change, where we're really hoping to bring these community leaders and representatives to these government tables as well, so that they also can understand the community better. Because if you're really going to talk about right to work, we don't want it to fail just like the other pilot programs. Some of these refugee communities have particular skills and particular experiences that are useful for our industries, but put also the wrong kind of placements or exclusive placements into particular industries only without real community engagement will actually spell out for a bad policy again and just a huge waste of resources. So we're really hoping to have a lot more comprehensive discussions this time around with the Human Resource Ministry along with this group.
All right. Thank you for your time. That was Elise Aryan Chan, Refugee Action Program Officer at Tenaga Nita, breaking down for us the number of refugees that we have in Malaysia, what support are they getting, and some of the issues that they faced. And I think, yeah, they are particularly vulnerable in this post-COVID-19 era because most of them are day wage earners and their ability to work has, of course, been curtailed.
Yeah, of course. I think Tenaga Nita is right in making occupation and jobs a key priority for them. I think a lot of people don't realize that immigrants' workforces are extremely hardworking, extremely aware that they need to make themselves relevant in this workforce. I just want to say one more thing. America's fortunes were built on immigrant labor. I mean, Sergey Brin, Elon Musk, Pierre Omidyar, they're all immigrants, including even Michael Moritz.
Yeah. Not too long ago, a lot of our grandparents were also immigrants coming 100%. From, you know. But up next, we'll be speaking about the COVID-19 situation in Philippines. That's happening after the 7:30 a.m. news bulletin. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.